Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Evan.
So today we're talking about adapting a text.
Yeah.
In this case, it's an open-ended kind of adaptation where you're starting from something you like and you know you want to make something out of it, but you don't know what.
So an example might be something like you love Avatar Last Airbender and you know that you want to make something inspired by, you know, I mean, we're the original. We're talking about the original here.
Right.
By the original animated series. But to do that, you have to identify what about that you care about, like what parts you would want to put forward. So that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Not Avatar.
No, no, that's true. That was just the first example that popped into my head. Today, we'll be talking about it in the context of our next project and sharing specifics of the work that we're adapting. And this will also serve as a sort of announcement of the next thing that we're making.
Right.
Yay. So let's talk about adapting a text. So I think the first thing that I want to ask you, Evan, before we get into this is, do you feel like all of our games are adaptations in some way?
I would not say that that's the case. Some of them come close.
Yeah.
Like Norlandia, very close to Chinatown as like a source material for that game.
Yeah.
Questlandia, I think, is more of a vibe.
I agree. And I'm really interested. I'm sorry if I caught you off guard with that question, because it's not in our notes and it just popped into my head. But I think that maybe one thing that I hope becomes clear to me, even as we talk, is like what kind of constitutes an adaptation? Because we have our games. I feel like we have three games that we've made that are on a real spectrum of like, Damn the Man, Save the Music, just 99% adaptation from the movie Empire Records.
Right.
So inspired by that movie down to very specific plot beats. Then Noirlandia, which is, I wouldn't put it in pure vibes category because noir has such, it has tropes that are established. Noir has established genre tropes. Questlandia, yeah, it's a vibe. Is a vibe an adaptation? It's not at all. The episode is not about the question, is a vibe an adaptation? But I'm just going to keep that question in the back of my mind as we're talking, because it might be helpful for me.
I mean, I'll say that I think there's such a thing as like a vibe as an intermediary between an inspiration and what you make.
Yeah.
Like, you watch The NeverEnding Story, it gives you a certain feeling, and then that feeling later becomes the inspiration for a work.
Sure, yeah. And then that feeling can become an adaptation. Ooh, yeah, okay, so.
So let's start with the question of finding something that you want to adapt in the first place. I don't actually know what we're going to say on this.
Well, I think
it's a part of the process.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we'll just, I feel like our strength has always been, keeping things specific so they can be interpreted more generally.
Right.
So we'll just start with the text that we are adapting.
So in our case, this inspiration started from your explorations of old out-of-print works.
Yeah, so I think this is going back quite a ways. I think it was maybe even shortly after I graduated from college that I had discovered the public domain transcription project called Project Gutenberg. It is an endeavor to preserve works in the public domain where it's like a collective volunteer effort of typing into pure HTML and also like EPUB readable formats, public domain works.
Right.
And these works can be anything, and it is anything. It's like everything from textbooks to cookbooks from the 1700s to people's memoirs from I mean, some of the stuff is even recent, but anything that either somebody more recently has explicitly put in the public domain or something dating back that is just out of copyright.
So you've been like tapping in and out of that project for years.
Yeah.
And as you and I became interested in perfumes and concocting things, you thought to go back and check for that topic.
Yeah. I mean, this actually, it predates the interest. Like one of the earliest things that I had discovered on Project Gutenberg were a number of early sort of texts that mixed chemistry with, I mean, it's almost like saying chemistry and magic, you know, when you, mm-hmm. you know, early texts that were texts by, we're going to put air quotes, like chemists. And, you know, when you're going and dating back to the 1700s, it's like often people's credentials are like by so-and-so, by Lord so-and-so, chemist, botanist, lawyer, musician.
Yeah, right.
Because there was a time where at least if you were part of a wealthy family, you could literally have all of those credentials because you just had a lot of time on your hands. So I was finding these texts that were like recipe books for recipes for waters to ward off the plague and recipes for a fine lady's cosmetic that were a mix of, I mean, some of the recipes are things that we would still literally use today. Others are like wacky, made up danger stuff.
And they're very funny. Like you started showing me these and I couldn't believe the language they were using or just like a potion to remove worms from the face. It's just like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of it is just legit. It's all funny. And some of it is just like turns of phrase. And yeah, there's one. So I will just say the specific book that we have grabbed onto is one that I did find years ago. And I was tickled by it when I first found it. I think it was like maybe going on a decade ago now. It was a long time ago that I found it uploaded to Project Gutenberg, and it delighted me because the book is called Toilet of Flora, which, you know, we start strong, right? And we would still say like eau de toilette or, you know, toiletries, but Toilet of Flora, like, it really is a strong start. And I've been delighted by it for years. And yeah, it has these recipes like, you know, and rub atop the head 3 to 4 times a day, and you shall never again have baldness, and thy hairs will shoot out to thy head. You know, it's really like, it's good stuff.
So, I mean, even before we chose that book in particular, we were talking about doing some kind of adaptation.
Yeah.
It felt like, here are these old recipe books of strange alchemical creations. And they are alternatingly hilarious and fascinating. And we looked at them and were like, well, we can do a reprint. We can bring any of these books back into print.
Yeah.
Because they're in the public domain.
Yeah. And that was our first idea. When we first started to think about the project, we weren't thinking about an adaptation at all. We were just thinking about a reprint because I loved the book and it's not particularly well laid out. I mean, on Project Gutenberg, it's not really laid out at all.
Right.
And there are people who are publishing it. I mean, it's in the public domain. So you can find these copies on Amazon and online that are like $60. And they're just, you can tell that they're kind of garbage. Like you can tell that
right.
Somebody's just made this low effort reprint of it with margins that stretch all the way to the edges of the page. And it felt sort of sad to me. So that was our first conversation.
I feel like we found out that like we had something that both was something we were very interested in, we were enjoying, and it also seemed to require just the skills that we have to offer, like having printed a number of books and laid them all out ourselves before.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, it would be by far our easiest project because somebody else has done the work for us.
Right.
And it's, you know, at that point, it becomes a layout project. But it also started to seem like just too much of a passion project because we would have needed funding for the printing. And there was just something a little bit off about the idea of asking for money. It as a Kickstarter just didn't quite come together for me. Like, it's a noble idea, but I don't know how many people even in our circle. I mean, I think people would support the project just to support us, but I don't want somebody to give us money to support us so we can print 200 copies of Toilet of Flora. I don't know.
I think this is like a transition point.
Yeah.
Where we were moving out of the realm of like, this is something we want to do. This is our inspiration. We figured that out.
Yeah.
And then it was like, what do we want to make this into?
Yeah. So, I mean, that I think is where we hit sort of the first question that we asked ourselves in adapting a work and that we've asked ourselves before, which is like, what do we like about the original? Because I think you have to know the answer to that before you can guide yourself to what's going to matter to you in the adaptation.
Right.
So what did we like about the original?
I mean, I feel like we've already said it, but,
it's funny.
The sort of, the old school language is delightful and often laugh out loud funny. Also, the sort of pseudoscientific promise of it, just the interest of it as like a snapshot of a certain kind of material science from a certain age. Really interesting.
It's really interesting. I mean, it's fascinating to see recipes or receipts, as the author calls them in the book, that are things that are just absolutely still applicable today. You know, something that's like a magnesium bath salt with lavender is something that you can buy at CVS today.
Right. And then there's others where it's like very dubious.
Extremely dubious to things that we now know literally hurt or killed people. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, there's the dubious and there's many dubious claims to, you know, and there's like a lot of like rubbing pigeons. It's like, kill 20 pigeons. Like, it is not a book that's kind to pigeons. I don't know why pigeons specifically. There's the dubious claims of like boiling down pigeon water to dangerous claims of, you know, face powders for women's cosmetics that now we know we're using lead. So it's this interesting mix of humor and also a time capsule of like, We're constantly learning things about science and safety and material safety. It really is a snapshot of a time that is not the time we're in now. And, you know, it also just happened to overlap with this new interest that both of us have that we've talked about in like sense of smell and modern perfumery. And it's really cool seeing some of the origins from a book from the 1700s.
So translating what we enjoy about the original piece to what we can make as like a new object in the world.
Yeah.
So the first consideration was, what if we just give it a nice layout?
That was the first one.
And I think we found two things pretty quickly. One is there's a question of where do you draw the line? Like, what counts as a modification and what doesn't? Some of these things were out of order or were in very bizarre ordering, for instance.
Yeah.
Would we reorder them? Mm-hmm. Some of the things could really use some cautions or like a little warning. But if we add that, we are very quickly exiting the realm of having a, you know, a authorless presentation of the original work. We're also talking about illustrations and what kind of art we would bring into it. And that also gets into a place where it's, you know, having a certain picture next to these recipes really changes the meaning and experience of the book. So it was difficult to figure out exactly what that entailed, a very true to source reprinting. And also we found that as a complete work, it wasn't that funny it wasn't that fascinating in parts.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something like 300 recipes in the book, and I mean, it's delightful, but it begs the question of like, what excites us about this? And what excited us wasn't just the idea that it would be a coffee table book that you sort of pick up off the shelf and you're like, oh, history was weird and it's in the past now. I mean, we really wanted to call out the best parts, like the highlight reel of the book. But to do that meant that now we as authors and curators were going to be entering the story. And so then there were immediate questions about what that would look like.
We had a conversation about whether this should be a part of role-playing, like the role-playing hobby. So I remember it, I was more in favor of it than you, although I don't know that we were ever like really clashing over it either.
Yeah.
But I felt like I didn't want it to just be a comedy book. I didn't want it to just be a historical document. I wanted it to feel like when you had this book, you could use it. But you should not use it to just make these recipes.
No,
that's the wrong way to use this book.
No, not like using it like as a real person in the real world, but maybe using it as a bard with a penchant for face powders in, you know, your D&D game or something. So,
right. Like I did feel like, you know, potions and potion making is kind of ubiquitous across many different fantasy role-playing games, but it's tough to go into a lot of detail on that in any given system. And this was an opportunity to look at a list of ingredients and recipes that were so outlandish that they feel like they belong in a fantasy setting, but they're also grounded in the real world with real measurements, with real plants to find, and real claimed effects.
Yeah. So tell me if this is accurate. So I feel like through our conversations in answering the question of like, what do we want an adaptation to be? My answer was like, I want to curate the strongest recipes and have the humor. We can add humor, but where we've added humor, it is very clear where our voice ends and the author's voice begins, or vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, where the author's voice ends, that if somebody's laughing at the phrase like, and the hairs will shoot out, I want them laughing because not thinking that Hannah and Evan were like, oh, we're so clever, we wrote in old-timey words.
Right.
That was kind of like the most important thing to me. And I was like, if it's a usable text, well, I'll come on board for that. And you early on were like, whatever we do, it should be a usable text at a role-playing game table.
Yeah. I became pretty convinced of that pretty quick, that that's both like a book I'd be more excited to own and more excited to share with other people.
Yeah. And so those weren't our only sort of criteria that we were going in with. But after that, we moved on to our next question then of, in making an adaptation, what do we want others to get from our take on the subject matter? I feel like there's got to be a better way to sum that up. But I really want to avoid just saying, like, what do we want others, like, what do other people like? Because I feel like that's never the right approach to making an adaptation. Like, what do other people like about Avatar? What do other people like about The Last Unicorn or Empire Records? It's like, what do we like?
How can we communicate what we like in a way that others will receive?
Yeah.
Which is maybe not quite a separate question than what we've been saying and what's to come. We want what we find to be surprising or amazing or funny about this original text to be seen and appreciated by other people. We want people to be able to like share this and say, this is hilarious. This is great. You should read this. And reprinting it without any changes wouldn't quite achieve that. So I think we came out of these conversations with three goals to guide what this was to become. One was, it should be funny. We're making a comedy book. You know, God save us. Two, it should be authentic. Like, the fact that this is a historical document is important. The fact that this is for real, like, some of the stuff you're reading seems too outrageous to be real, but it is real. But, that has to be communicated.
Yeah.
So if we're adding jokes, it can't be confusing the authenticity of what we're presenting. And then three, it should be usable. This should be a book that you can bring into a game, bring to a table, and play with it and have fun with it.
Three things.
Three
things.
Great.
It's great to have a list of three things. That's, I never want a list.
The magic number.
I can take a list of four things, nothing more.
Not the magic number.
Not the, but yeah, generally three. Three is good. So the sort of fun and overwhelming part comes next, which is after we identified our goals and like what I'm going to call like our sort of North Stars of the adaptation, then it's like the brainstorm.
So it's a free-for-all.
Yeah.
What could possibly be in this book? What could possibly be a part of it? And in a two-person team, that even means throwing out passing thoughts that aren't even that good, because you could be inspiring the other person to come up with a great idea.
Yeah. And it also means throwing out passing thoughts that maybe you know are just entirely out of the scope of what's reasonable. But there's no bad ideas in a brainstorm. I mean, to say we want to include a glossary definition for every single term mentioned in the book. And, you know, you're like, oh, wow. Okay, wait, there's 3,000 ingredients mentioned in that book. I don't know if there are. And maybe knowing that, with like printing costs, we have to keep our book to 120 pages. Like you can sort of know that you're overshooting, but I think it's important to get like everything that you might possibly want and can think of down on paper and then call from there instead of starting from like, this is 120 pages. And so we should omit the entire section about bath salts and
You know, I wonder how well this would apply to more hierarchical, like game development.
Yeah, how so?
And because I feel like there's pressure to put down ideas that are not offensively bad and outrageous. But I find it really helpful to be able to voice those ideas. One of them that seems offensively bad, but actually was sitting as a real possibility for a while, was what if we make two versions of the book, one that's made into this usable comedy and one that's just the pure authentic layout?
I don't know why that's offensively bad. It's just a lot of
work. The project,
right? Exactly. I know. I think it's still such a great idea. I mean, one of our early ideas was like, okay, to like really honor this text, we'll do our like little haha role playing game version, and then we'll also do maybe a physical printing, maybe a digital only version where we have just relayed out the original. I'm still not totally abandoning the digital only. I mean, but also,
well, I mean,
we love an overpromise. So
here's another aspect of the brainstorm. Concurrently, I was doing some layout and testing some of these ideas, you know, like seeing how it would look on a page with the knowledge that it could be completely thrown out. And one thing that became clear quickly is that if we were going to do two different versions, we could not use the same layout.
Yeah.
Like some of these recipes are 10 times longer than others. And in the book we're making, we can just trim that down or trim it away. In an accurate reproduction, it would need a whole different design philosophy.
Yeah, because, I mean, you started really early on playing around with some sample layouts, and your layouts were making space for all of the extra things that we want on this page, which are, it's actually, I mean, it's a deceptively simple layout because we're sort of focusing in on some of the shorter receipts, but then adding in footnotes and asides, and maybe like a footnote that leads into a long aside from some like apocryphal historical story. And
right.
And that, in terms of like the graphic design of coming up with a layout, that's huge work. And it really required that work to be duplicated. Yeah, like you're saying, for those ideas to work together, which I think gets us to our next thing, which is after doing the big brainstorm, you have to then identify which ideas in the brainstorm are in tension with, are like, I don't want to say in conflict because that feels a little too strong, but are mm-hmm. are in tension with your original goals.
Right. I think in our case, so this is, I guess, something that's going to happen regularly if you have multiple goals for a project. You're going to start turning up things that it satisfies one goal, the more it conflicts with another.
Oh, interesting. Can you think of any example for this project?
So,
I mean, besides the one that I guess we just said.
In this project, I feel like the historical authenticity and the humor were in tension.
Yeah.
I feel like there's this, if it comes off as just a free-for-all comedy joke fest, you won't trust that what you're reading is authentic, and you'll lose some of the better jokes and better, like, surprises from the text if you think, probably Evan or Hannah just added that in. It's too good to be part of the original.
Yeah, and that inspired a really early conversation and disagreement between us where we were also just talking about sort of like, what are the different voices at play in this text? Because we're already curating. And so you have the original voice of the author, who I think is named Pierre Boucaux. And then you have Hannah and Evan's voice, which even if we didn't do any other cautions or introduction, like our voice is already there as the invisible editors.
Right.
But then if you're going to add footnotes and historical asides, who wrote those? Those are less funny as Hannah and Evan. And so that was our question of like, who's for our editions, who is writing these? And you had pitched early on, kind of to come up with like a new author, like an author who is adapting this text, who maybe disagreed with the original and had his own voice and flair for the dramatic and absurd. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I like hated the idea, but I understood. I didn't like it, but I understood it.
Well, so there was one voice that we both liked immediately, which was a sort of dry, explanatory voice to add footnotes and,
yeah.
You know, call out little things, but in just sort of a distanced, like, this asks for river water. What river should you go? Here's a simple guide.
Yeah. And so what did we come up, what sort of, where did we land?
We both agreed on that. It's like, the jokes we wanted to tell came off in that voice. But I felt like mixed about, well, this is where the goal of being a role-playing game aide came into conflict too, because I wanted to be able to talk about some outlandish magical things, you know, that you could substitute a unicorn's horn in this recipe. And I wasn't sure whether that made sense in the dry tone, and also whether it got in the way of us being historically accurate in some places, because that's yet another goal, that we could discuss some of the ingredients used in these recipes and give you an actual foundation of what that ingredient was and where it was found and what went into getting it in that historic time period. Because that kind of grounded in history discussion, I think, adds a lot of depth to a fantasy use.
So I think where we've landed, at least right now, is that this other layer, this sort of in-world, dry, footnote addition layer is going to be in the voice of like an alchemical society that would have been in operation at the time. So something like, you know, Toilet of Flora, although we'll likely change the name, but Toilet of Flora with additions by the Royal Alchemical Society of blah, blah. Right?
Right.
So that's kind of where we've landed.
We've decided to allow that society to be a little bit more magical.
Yeah.
Than historic, which is probably the right move. It's hard to know where to draw the lines between the domains of authenticity and role-playing game use yeah. and comedy.
And this might be the point where we get into vibes, too, because you and I aren't historians.
Right.
But we can do vibes. we can do alchemical 1700s. Ooh, find a unicorn horn. I feel like that's a voice that I can put on that hat and do a fancy dance with it.
Yeah.
As they say, that's a saying.
I feel good about where we landed in that conversation. And I guess once we had that sorted, we reintroduced the concerns that would have interrupted our original brainstorm, which are, how long should this be? How much should it cost? How much work should it take to complete? How ambitious is the entire piece of it? And then also even how saleable is it? Like how much is this going to appeal?
Yeah. And I would say those are the conversations where, like, that's kind of where we are now.
Right. We're engaging with those.
We've answered some of them, and others are just like, that's going to be the work of making the thing, is we're still kind of figuring out our template for how many footnotes and how many asides, both historical and fictional.
We still haven't decided what kind of artwork is going to be in the book and who's going to be making that. Like, I personally love the idea of doing some old school, like, botanical illustration, but I also have to recognize the ambition of training myself.
Oh, you mean you?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we do have a class locally, although I don't know if you can get into it. It's a very popular class, but at least that means that, you know, a stone's throw away from us, we have some classically trained botanical illustrators. So
you know, that's true.
We should talk to them and see if they're weird. I feel like probably a botanical illustrator is like somebody who, you know, what's a botanical illustrator? What kind of life?
Will it feel like they come from the past?
I think that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah. I imagine it being like just like somebody with a really long Gandalf pipe and like a very dusty study who unrolls their scroll.
Yeah, I would love to hire someone like
Oh, gosh. Who's
like, I want that to be our intern.
Well, listen, paid intern. This is Gandalf.
A little Gandalf
paid intern.
Wandering around. Yeah.
He's in his final year of college and has been for the past 230 years. All right. So
that brings us to where we are now, which is having a rough plan of what we want to make, what the basic layout and goals of it are, and we're moving into production, like making that real, with the understanding that it's still a little too ambitious if we bring all the ideas we've had to the final product, but it's going to be through the process of actually doing the work that we'll learn what's reasonable to accomplish and what was overambitious.
Yeah. And what we've talked about over the past year also, that we've stepped back from our, up to this point, we had kind of kept a once a year Kickstarter schedule, but also every single project was delayed by quite a while because
right.
The scope was always bigger than we imagined. So I think in the past, this would have been when we made the Kickstarter. Like we would have had a lot of unanswered questions, but we would have made sort of some mock-ups and templates and
And we have a strong enough idea of what we're going for that we could pitch it.
And I think there is nothing wrong with that, except for the fact that we've learned that that's stressful for us and leads to projects where we're always wrong estimating how long it's going to take. So we've really wanted to answer more of the questions earlier on before we just want to know exactly what we're doing before we put it into the world, it forward to the world.
You know, I think as a rule, if you can afford to get further along in the project before doing a Kickstarter and getting money for it, that's to your benefit. You'll have a stronger thing to show and a better idea of what you're promising and what it'll take.
Yeah. And the keyword being afford.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a luxury.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the final things that I'll say is in terms of like, who is this for and how marketable is this? I mean, I'm excited about the idea. It feels like a passion project. I think that getting farther along in it for me means that if it turns out there's not that big an audience, it's going to be the difference between a 5-month turnover and a year and a half turnover. And, you know, if it makes $10,000, like we say all the time, like those $10,000 spread out over 5 months that it takes to get it out, or 4 months, ooh, that would be so nice, versus a year and a half.
Right.
Like that money takes on a different meaning. Also, my mom really likes the idea. So I don't really know what else I'm going to say about that. My mom really likes the idea and she never understands what we're doing. But this one, she got it. So,
I mean, that's something that's worth thinking about. I mean, this is maybe a little out of order, but I feel like it is a special consideration when you think about whether other people are going to like what you're making, whether it will be like financially successful. And that's something that you can't fully know, and you don't want it to let it to have an outsized influence on what you're making.
No.
You don't want it to drag the project out of your own heart and your own interest into something you're reading and assuming about others.
I mean, this gets into like out of the realm of adaptations and just into the realm of also like self-work and acceptance.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not on social media much anymore, and I'm not on Twitter anymore, but I felt like one of the most like heartbreaking things that I used to see were when somebody would do a Kickstarter for a project that was really close to their heart and then feel a lot of grief and sadness when it didn't do numbers.
Right.
And that's just getting into self-work. But I think it's an important question too. Like, now we're talking about, can you handle emotionally if your project doesn't make $40,000?
Well, but we've talked about that. Is part of the early conversations.
That's
right?
True.
It really
That's true.
Is.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things where you have to accept you don't fully know.
Yeah.
You have to accept some risk, but you want to get a little dose of that kind of thinking.
You do, yeah.
You want to say, like, I do want other people. I have goals of other people enjoying this and it being popular.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. Just get a little dose of that.
Yeah.
Let that influence the project, but don't obsess about it. Don't let it completely morph what it is.
And I mean, and that's not to say it's like, just because I've seen it and felt sad about it doesn't mean that I'm somehow like exempt from it. I mean, I certainly have, even when I think I'm exempt from it or I've accepted, like, oh, I'll be okay. You know, if this project makes $10,000, which is sort of the minimum, it's like, if it made $8,000, I think I'd be sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then if it made 10,000, maybe I would also be sad, because maybe I have, you know, I have some secret hopes.
Right.
Secret hopes. But you're right. It does become part of the early conversations.
Hopefully we've got a nice balance here of something that's going to be appreciated by others and is still something we each are completely in love with.
Mm-hmm. And I can count on my mom to back it. Although I can't, because she usually forgets, but that's not her fault. She's all vibe. She brings the vibes. She doesn't really bring the follow through, but she does bring the vibes. So we love her for that. All right. So that's what we have to say about adaptations.
I think we probably have another episode to come. when we get further along and figure out more of what we're doing.
But yeah.
That's how we got to where we are now.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good topic. It was helpful for me, so maybe it will be helpful for others.
The Design Doc intro-outro theme was written by our friend, Pat King. Thanks, Pat.
Design Doc is supported by the Turtle Bun Patreon. At patreon.com/turtlebun, you can offer us a little bit of monthly support to get things like weekday workday logs. Every Friday, weekly workday log. Thank you. Every Friday, we publish a log of what we did the entire week, and we've been really consistent with it. And it's a really good way for us to be accountable to the work week and also look back every Friday and see what we've done and be proud of how much work in progress we're making and to share that with you.
We also sometimes will share in progress versions of what we're making. And very occasionally, just whole little games or add-ons just for Patreon backers.
So that is patreon.com/turtlebun. And we will leave a link to the Toilet of Flora and Project Gutenberg in today's show notes. And we'll also have links in the show notes to things like our Discord, which is an active Discord where we talk about game design and Star Trek. A lot of Star Trek fans in the Discord.
Star Trek, yeah.
And also, we will have links to all of the ways to get in contact with us if you have questions or comments about Design Doc or adaptations. Thank you for listening. We'll see you soon, heroes.